this is almost exactly like 2016. It's almost eerie. And then as, you know, Trump got re-elected, I'm like, man, it's so weird how this just continues to follow the same process. And from a macro standpoint, everything feels the same. Could we see a similar run, a 10 or 20x run from here, right? Like, could we see Bitcoin go to 1 million or 2 million by the end of 2025 or early 2026? We could. It's not impossible. I give it a very low chance of that happening. Like, I would say maybe, you know, 2 to 3% chance it goes to a million, and I'm like much less than 1% chance it goes to 2 million. But that would be sort of the equivalent of 2016, 2017. More likely, I think we hit somewhere in that range of kind of 200,000 to a million or so. I still have my price target of 475,000. You know, people get on my case about that. I'm like, I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm saying this is just my price range based on probabilities that I look at. And so it might be too high, it might be too low. It's guaranteed to be wrong. And I think as the bull market rages on in Bitcoin, I think that all of these proof of stake cryptos are just going to absolutely go wild and proliferate. And I think it's going to be worse than 2022. So all of the lessons from 2022 with FTX and with BlockFi and with Voyager and with all these other places, that's nothing. I think it will pale in comparison to what is coming. And I think people are going to get absolutely destroyed. And so my one last piece of advice for people is, like, you can speculate in that stuff if you want to, but save in Bitcoin. Please, please, please save in Bitcoin and don't use leverage, or you're going to get wrecked. And I promise you, you'll get wrecked. And even governments might start getting wrecked. I mean, are you kidding me? If you start putting like proof of stake crypto on the balance sheets of governments, it's just going to be a disaster. Bitcoin is a technology. It's a monetary technology that helps the quality of your life to improve and get cheaper over time versus the dollar and everything dollar related. So crypto and lottery tickets and all of this other stuff, and even stocks, penny stocks, meme stocks, stuff that people get into, those are all these desperate attempts to get rich quickly, but they have no lasting value or very little lasting value. And you have way more of a chance of getting wrecked over time than actually striking it rich and making it big. So I just tell people, like, just, you know, be conservative. Matt Odell has the best quote that I think that everybody should take to heart. Stay humble, stack sats. Like, that's all you got to do. And if you do that, if you put your head down and work hard and stack sats, regardless of the price of Bitcoin, if you do that for 10 years, you will have a different life 10 years from now.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Joe.
Yeah, for sure. So for folks who may not know you, Dr. Jeff, you have been in the Bitcoin space for years now, and you were one of the very first accounts that I followed on Twitter. You're now no longer on Twitter, but nevertheless, you're still, you know, doing your good work, pumping out great research, great analysis. Where's your head at with the market right now? I mean, things certainly haven't been, from a market like froth standpoint, more things haven't been happening for Bitcoin in years, right? The last time I could think of Bitcoin being this action packed was, 2022. Right, with the fall of FTX, right? So where's your head at right now, right? There's a whole lot of stuff. How are you thinking about everything?
Well, that's a loaded question. I feel like I could already go in about five different directions with that. So first of all, you mentioned I'm not on Twitter anymore. I'll make my public service announcement right off the bat. I'm only on Nostr now. And that matters because there are imposters of me all over the internet. And none of those are me, right? So if you see me trying to get in touch with you on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook or wherever, it's not me. I'm not trying to get you to invest in my secret fund. I'm not trying to get you to send me Bitcoin or anything. Please, please be careful with the imposters out there. I'm only on Nostr, and you can find me. I'm Dr. Jeff on Nostr. Okay, so where are we right now from like a cyclical standpoint? There's a lot of stuff going on right now. I think everybody who paid attention to Trump 1.0 kind of knows at least a little bit what to expect with Trump 2.0. Some of it feels surreal. I keep saying to people, all of this was inevitable. For those of us who have been in this space for, you know, 4, 5, 10 years or so, we've been waiting for this moment for a very long time. We've been waiting for the moment where the government realizes that they can no longer beat Bitcoin, that they can't stop it, that there's nothing they can do about it, so they might as well just get on board with it. And we're now at the might as well get on board with it phase. It almost feels kind of surreal. It's very strange, but it's not unexpected. So we're starting to see banks flip their narrative on Bitcoin, and they're suddenly very excited about Bitcoin, and unfortunately they're excited about crypto too. There are pros and cons to all of this. The governments are getting on board with it. What I love seeing right now are things moving through states, right? So states are trying to pass legislation to get Bitcoin strategic reserves. I'm a big fan of state level government if there's going to be a government. I do not like the federal government. I think the federal government needs to go away, honestly. I know that causes a lot of people to get upset. It at least needs to be desized or shrunk down by about 90 to 99% as far as I'm concerned. But that's another story. So where are we with everything? We have a lot of things that look really good right now. I think from a macroeconomic perspective, I'm still very bullish. We can get into that. And I know you like talking macro too. So we can talk about why. I look at three big things, and one of them is a surprise that I don't see anybody else talking about, or only a very small number of people talking about. We all know that global M2 monetary supply expanding is a good thing for Bitcoin. It took a bit of a hiccup because the dollar was so strong in the fourth quarter of 2024. It directly affects global M2 monetary supply. And I told people, I said, you watch, once the dollar breaks, we're going to see the global M2 monetary supplies start to pick up again. And so the dollar broke. It peaked a little above 110. Right now it's at 107.97 or so. And so I think that we're going to see a repeat of what happened in 2017. We're leading up into President Trump's first inauguration. The dollar was very strong. Interest rates were ramping higher. And he said, I don't like a strong dollar. I don't like high interest rates. Let's do what we can to push it down. And I think that's going to happen again this time. So I think throughout 2025, we're going to see a generally weakening dollar despite all of these tariff talks. I think interest rates are actually kind of fine where they are. I think they're in a normal range right now, and that's good, in the 4% range. And then what people aren't talking about is I think manufacturing is finally making a comeback in the US. So it's been in a recession basically since early 2022. It's been a non-starter for a very long time. And I think what nobody is talking about is the fact that manufacturing is, and the forward-looking indicators are all starting to look like it's starting to expand again. Why does that matter? Because when the PMI, manufacturing PMI, starts to increase again, above 50, starts to expand again, that's very bullish for Bitcoin. If you can look back at charts and look, when the manufacturing PMI goes above 50 and starts ramping higher, that's generally bullish for the economy, and it's very bullish for Bitcoin. And that's usually when you see these kind of large price appreciation happen, these quarters and even like a year or so of significant price appreciation. So I'm very bullish. So when you have an expanding global M2 monetary supply, when you have a weakening dollar, and when you have a finally expanding manufacturing PMI above 50, that is very, very bullish for Bitcoin. So I'm bullish until something changes. I'll leave it there. Let's go where you want to go.
I love it. Let's go through those three things you just spoke about. I actually, as you were speaking, I pulled each one of these up on my terminal. You haven't been on Twitter, so maybe you've seen this chart, maybe you haven't. Some people get really upset about it. But since September of 2023, Bitcoin and global M2 denominated in USD, they've been tracking one another to a T until this recent bout of dollar strength that happened a couple of months back, or began a couple of months back, and that caused these two to dislocate. Global M2 began contracting, not as a result of actual absolute money supply falling, but relative to the dollar, it was becoming worth less. And so that's why this fell. Bitcoin kind of dislocated from it. But I do see what you're seeing now that we have global M2 once again expanding, the dollar coming back down from its ascent. You know, that's extremely bullish for Bitcoin. We saw that Bitcoin was able to do, resoundingly well, even during this period of dollar strength. Now that the dollar is weakening, it seems like that one thing that was holding the dollar back is kind of now not in play anymore.
Yeah. And so I guess my take home points are one, we all know that Bitcoin follows the trajectory of global M2 generally with a lag, right? So there's this lag period of kind of 10 to 12 weeks or so. Yeah, this is a 10 week thing. That's a general concept. Two, though, it doesn't have to follow it precisely. So it has been eerily following it, I think, over the last year and a half or so. I think it's possible that Bitcoin is going to front run global M2 going forward. So I was actually expecting, by the way, that it would dip down to 75 to 85K. Over the last, like basically the last month or so. And I thought the impetus that might do it was when we saw that headline from the Department of Justice that they were cleared to sell their 65,000 Bitcoin. Do you remember that announcement? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, 3 weeks ago or something. To me, that if they would have just dumped that on the market, we would have gotten my price target of somewhere in the 75 to 85K range. I think it got down to like maybe 89K before it popped back up again. So the way I interpret this is that's a great thing to look at. It's very important, but it doesn't necessarily have to follow it to the T, even though it has in the past, in the more recent history. So I think it starts to front run it a little bit. I do expect kind of choppiness in the near term for the price of Bitcoin. I don't necessarily have a real strong conviction that it's going to shoot higher very quickly. But I think as the market starts to digest the changes that Trump is bringing on and we start to figure out where these tariffs are going, I think what the market is going to start realizing is this catalyst of manufacturing, that it's starting to pick up again and that it's actually here for real and it's here to stay. And as the market starts to accept that, that we're actually not heading into a recession. And I will say, I call out the recessionistas all the time on Noster still and on these interviews. They've been wrong since 2022. I was a recessionista in 2022. I thought for sure we were going to head into a recession. And I think the only reason we didn't was because of the massive fiscal deficits that the government ran. But so I figured that out in early 2023. And I've been kind of, you know, mildly mocking the recessionistas since that time. They're still calling for it. There are still very many people that are freaking people out because they're saying we have a 1929 style or worse crash coming. It may have started yesterday with DeepSeek. It may be started with the yen carry trade unwinding, you know, all these things, these narratives that people follow. And I'm just like, they're just wrong. I look at the macro data every day. I listen to the bear porn every day. And I'm like, you're just wrong. You're interpreting events wrong. We are not at late stage business cycle. We're at early stage recovering business cycle. And as it becomes more clear in 2025, and I believe it will become more clear in 2025, I think the biggest risk going forward for the end of 2025 and early 2026 is that the economy actually gets too hot. I think that we're gonna run with that problem of what do we do if GDP starts ripping and inflation starts ripping, and then the central banks are gonna start talking like, dude, we need to cool this economy off. We need to figure out plans for that. So that's what I'm looking for. And I think this is all very exciting. And I think that this bodes well for 2025 as far as risk assets and especially as far as Bitcoin is concerned.
Extremely well said. Yeah, I mean, if we just plainly consider that, generally speaking, PMIs begin contracting into, you know, the end of the business cycle. They're expanding right now, particularly manufacturing, right? We know services makes up a higher percentage of the United States GDP, but with manufacturing expanding, that's a very telltale sign that the U.S. economy is headed back up. It's not headed back down. One thing we can take a look at as well is this correlation between the S&P 500 and the City Economic Surprise Index. This is one of my favorite ones to use to gauge what the market's reaction function is to the Fed, right? Because if good news is bad news, and that means when economic data is good, it's bad for the stock market because that means the Fed will either keep rates where they are or hike. But right now we're in a good news is good news regime. This is the rolling 10-day correlation, so it's a little more choppy. So when we get good economic data, it's good news for the economy, it's good news for the stock market, right? That's the regime we're in now. And it seems like all the recessionistas who've been fighting this data that we've been getting that's been good, they've missed out, you know, since 2022, you mentioned, they've missed out on the run of the S&P 500 from sub 4,000 to, you know, 6,000 points, right? So it seems like they don't really have a leg to stand on. And now that rates have come back down, I'm looking at WERP right now. There are, you know, basically only 50 bips worth of cuts, two small cuts priced in between now and January of next year. You know, it seems to me that we've basically arrived at neutral. We're going to be in recovery for the rest of this year. And so to that end, I kind of do agree with you that the main risks ending 2025, heading into 2026 are not recession. They're actually, you know, reacceleration and inflation.
Right. And then the central banks are going to be talking about how do we slow this down? And they can induce a recession for sure. Right. They can jack up rates. They can do crazy things that slows the economy down. But we're nowhere near that right now. To your point, we haven't even seen a PMI above 50 yet. That's coming still. And so when the manufacturing PMI comes above, first of all, the recessionistas are all going to come out in full force and say this is a fluke. The same thing happened back in early 2024. It's just a one off, blah, blah, blah. And they're going to be wrong. And then February is going to come around and they're like, oh, shoot, I guess it is expanding. And I guess this is good. And what I love about it, by the way, and this, again, gets back to like what I love about Bitcoin and what I hate about the government and their monopoly on money, is this is fantastic for the lower and middle classes, right? The return of manufacturing to America is fantastic for the blue collar workers. We don't even have blue collar workers anymore. And most of them have been just decimated and crushed, and all of their jobs were given away to China and to other countries. And that, I do believe it's coming back. And I think that is fantastic, because I think we're going to see a resurgence in the U.S. middle class. So anyways, I'm very excited for it. I think it bodes well for the U.S. in general. It bodes well for Bitcoin. It bodes well for these groups of people that have been getting just decimated by the monetary policies over the last several years and decades. So I'm pretty optimistic. To me, it feels like 1984, 1985. I know you're too young to remember this, but I actually do remember this. I was only a kid back then, but I remember this palpable optimism when Reagan got reelected for a second term, right? Like Rocky Balboa was winning everything. Top Gun was crushing it. All these things, like there was just this feeling in the air of good vibes and good times. And I think that we're going to see a return of the good times to the U.S. again. So I'm pretty optimistic, even though I'm not very political. I can read the macroeconomic tea leaves, and it leaves me feeling pretty good.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's something that does get lost, kind of lost in all of the data, right? If we take a look too closely at the numbers, we don't necessarily look at what, you know, is important to the culture and the American people. And largely over the last, you know, decade and a half, two decades, since the early to mid 2000s has been about, you know, our jobs being put over to other countries and basically like this hollowing out of middle America. And I've been reading a whole lot. People do seem to agree with you. They seem to agree that, this feels a lot like Reagan's second term. This feels like, you know, a lot of moving out of the 70s, out of that, you know, Jimmy Carter slump and into, the late 70s, early 80s. That sense of optimism does seem to be back in America, which is just wonderful to see, right? Because at the end of the day, the economic data we're receiving is just meant to be a proxy for how well the economy is doing. Unfortunately, the people who create this economic data, you know, they throw a couple of different things in there. They try to skew it so it's less reflective of the economy. But at the end of the day, that's what we're trying to gauge is, you know, the will, how well are the American people doing? And it seems like now more than ever, we're in a really good spot. I want to, the last chart I want to go, over here in this little pack I assembled is what you just mentioned, the ISM manufacturing PMI in white, and then Bitcoin's price in blue. And you know that Bitcoin was really, really struggling when ISM dipped under, you know, substantially under 50 during COVID. These are monthly resolutions. And then, as ISM came back above 50, you could see Bitcoin obviously soared, right? ISM came down for the next couple of years, Bitcoin followed. And Bitcoin, even still, right, despite this very, very tepid action in PMI, now that we're once again, you know, it's managed to rise. And now that we're once again approaching 50, right, it seems like that's an extremely, extremely good setup for Bitcoin. What are your thoughts on this chart?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I'm talking about. And very few people are mentioning this right now. I will give a hat tip, by the way, to Julian Bittle of Real Vision. He has been talking lots about this, and so he's spreading the word too. But I think it's just fantastic. And I've been, and the reason why I like to talk about it is because I've been downplaying the importance of manufacturing in the U.S. for the last couple of years. Because, as you alluded to earlier, the services sector is so much larger. It's such a bigger part of the U.S. GDP that it doesn't really matter that much. But going forward, I think it will matter greatly. So as we still have a solid services economy and now an improving and expanding manufacturing economy, that just means that we're starting to fire on all cylinders. So I think as we head into 2025, I think people are going to be surprised to the upside that GDP is actually growing, that we're not heading into this recession that people keep calling for. I think we're going to see GDP growth accelerating, and we're actually going to see inflation at least kind of persistent, probably chopping around where it is, possibly increasing a bit as well. And when you have that environment of a accelerating economy and accelerating inflation, though not out of control inflation, that combo is very good for risk assets, and it's actually exceptional for Bitcoin. So for me, I can't look at this and not be excited and not be optimistic. And I run a fund, so it matters what I the conclusions that I draw. And when I hear the people, you know, on TV yelling and screaming, they're usually like selling subscription newsletters, right? They're not held responsible for their portfolios. They get paid to have impressions and to get clicks and to get paid subscribers. My goal is to make money for my clients and to do well in my fund. So when I look at this data, I think this is the time to be bullish. This is not the time to be sitting on the sidelines being all cautious. I think as long as we're in a bull market, as long as it looks like manufacturing PMI is going to head above 50 and then surge higher for the next year or so, that is a time to be risk on. That is a time to be bullish. That is a time to be very long Bitcoin as well.
Phenomenal. I want to shift gears into taking a look at this Bitcoin cycle compared to 2017. So Checkmate brought this up, but you also kind of alluded to it earlier. We're in a very similar setup to when Trump first came into office, January 2017. Rates were relatively high. Dollar was relatively strong. He didn't like either of those things. Both of those things came down. And over the course of the year, Bitcoin managed to rise from something like $1,000 to $20,000. We're in a very similar setup right now, right? He just had an interview. I think it was like day one or day two. He was signing executive orders in his office, which, by the way, is very fun to see. I love when the press is in there and he's signing them live. Mm-hmm. It was even cooler when he, you know, regardless of what anyone thinks of the guy, I think it's very, very funny when he's in a sold out stadium signing executive orders like it's the WWE. But one of the questions that was given to him was he said that interest rates have to come down. And then the reporter said, "Do you think Jerome Powell will listen to you?" And he said, "Yeah." Like very, very, you know, kind of lackadaisically, just said, yeah. So, you know, what do you think about this current setup? Do you believe it mirrors 2017? Because actually, eerily enough, right, speaking about eerie charts, we talked about Bitcoin tracking global M2 with the 70-day lag to like a very strange degree. Bitcoin is lining up nearly one-to-one at this point in the cycle from where it was in 2017. Obviously, from the standpoint of percentages, it would seem impossible for Bitcoin to go on a run from a percentage perspective like it did in 2017 and 2025, given that we're now a $2 trillion asset. But I guess, you know, do you feel that this cycle has a lot of similarities to 2017? And if so, what are they?
Yeah. And, you know, before I nuked my Twitter account, I kind of wish I kept a historical version of it, is I was talking about this way before Trump and in the re-election. This is almost exactly like 2016. It's almost eerie. And then as, you know, Trump got re-elected, I'm like, man, it's so weird how this just continues to follow the same process. And from a macro standpoint, everything feels the same. The differences, I will say, is at the time when Trump was inaugurated in 2017, stocks were not overvalued at that time. They were actually pretty low valued, and Bitcoin for itself hadn't had any major spikes leading up to it. What's throwing it off a little bit this time from 2016, 2017 was that we had the ETF approval, which caused a lot of hype and a lot of excitement in early 2024. That caused the price to spike. And then I think it basically took the whole rest of 2024 for those gains to be sort of digested, for those moves to be consolidated. And so now I look at it like stocks are very highly, very richly valued, right? From a price to sales, price to earnings ratio, especially the Mag 7, those stocks, very, very highly priced right now. So they have less upside when I see that. And I don't like seeing that. You want something to be oversold and not overbought when you're buying into it. And so, yes, I think the Bitcoin cycle is very similar. Could we see a similar run, a 10 or 20x run from here, right? Like, could we see Bitcoin go to 1 million or 2 million by the end of 2025 or early 2026? We could. It's not impossible. I give it a very low chance of that happening. Like I would say maybe, 2 to 3% chance it goes to 1 million, and I'm like much less than 1% chance it goes to 2 million. But that would be sort of the equivalent of 2016, 2017. More likely, I think we hit somewhere in that range of kind of 200,000 to 1 million or so. I still have my price target of 475,000. You know, people get on my case about that. I'm like, I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm saying this is just my price range based on probabilities that I look at. And so it might be too high. It might be too low. It's guaranteed to be wrong. And so I don't really care. I just want to be directionally right, sort of in the ballpark. And I want to be right in my timing. And that's how I look at everything now. And until something changes, I still think that we probably peak somewhere around the fourth quarter of 2025. I will be looking for signs to start getting a little more cautious at that time. You know, I have my cycle, the stuff that I follow from a macro standpoint goes from bear to bear crab to bull crab to bullish. And then it goes back to bear again. And so we're in that bull phase right now. I've fully come out of that bull crab into bullish. This is the time to be bullish. All dips are for buying. At some point, though, the fun will end and you have to be careful. And we're going to go back, I think, into another bear market. But we're not even anywhere close to that right now. The economy is just starting to rev up again. We're at early stages. We're seeing commodities start to inflate, start to increase in price. that's another early stage indicator. We're not late stage at all. And we're just starting to see the central banks get on board. I think now that the dollar is weakening, we're going to hear announcements from all over the world of other central banks. And this is important, by the way. Most people are watching the Fed. I don't think the Fed matters that much this cycle. And again, that's actually similar to 2016, 2017. Most of the liquidity from those cycles came from China and came from Europe and from Japan as well. Not as much from the US. And I think we're going to have something similar this cycle where the Fed will kind of just be doing its thing. The Fed funds rate will kind of be about where it is. Liquidity will be meh, but we're going to see a huge liquidity injections from the other world central banks because their economies are actually really hurting. The US is doing pretty well comparatively. So look for liquidity to come from elsewhere. And because Bitcoin is a global asset, it will absorb that global liquidity from coming from outside the US.
It really is it's a wonderful thing to see. And it's great to be a student of cycles, because then if you pay attention to what happened in prior cycles, you can line them up and go, this, and this are similar. Therefore, I believe assets will move in this direction. And you're right about probabilities. I mean, so many people get fixated on, I need to know a target. I need to make it so my mental modeling puts me at a target. But you just need to be directionally correct, as you said. Like, all of your modeling should not, you know, it should put you in a general ballpark. But what you want more than anything is to be directionally correct, because if you fight the trend, you lose, and you lose a lot of money, especially when you're running a fund. I had Checkmate on last week, and this is exactly what he was talking about. He said, you know, I have a feeling price will land somewhere between this and this, but I will ultimately be completely wrong on where it ends up. And that's just the case, you know, for every cycle. And I think it's an important learning lesson. So I'm happy you said it. I'm taking a look at commodity prices now and also the dollar. Yeah, crude is up 4%, or WTI is up 3.5%. Copper is up 4.75%. Brent is up 3.8%. Gold and silver are both up 5%. Over the last month, Bitcoin is up 8%. And the dollar on a monthly resolution is finally down. It's down by about 0.5%. And so, yeah, no, that is almost certainly the exact setup that we're experiencing right now. I want to ask you about some of the regulatory things that are coming into play this cycle. Namely, a lot of people had their eyes on the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve, but I really think that was, people are missing the forest for the trees with that one. When it came to Trump getting into office, the thing that I became most excited about after he mentioned it was the repeal of SAB 121, which was obviously this, you know, bulletin put forward by the SEC that basically said, hey, there's really no law saying you can't custody Bitcoin, but if you do, we're going to have to count it. We're going to have you count it as a liability on your balance sheet. And also, we are going to audit you to high heaven and probably shut your business down. That has been repealed. SAB 122 came out basically saying, all right, we rescinded that entire last bulletin. Go nuts. And so it's out there now, right? This thing that you and I have been talking about, and Nick and I have been writing about over at the Bitcoin Layer, and what Nick ultimately views Bitcoin's final destination to be is this pristine collateral. Now, at least stateside, banks can begin exploring that. And that brings about, you know, an entirely new cohort of individuals to invest in Bitcoin, financial institutions, the same financial institutions that get bailed out by the Fed when times are tough, the same financial institutions that can create financial instruments using Bitcoin, right? So for me, this is the most substantial development. If we get nothing from Trump for the remaining 4 years, I think this will have been enough. What are your thoughts about the repeal of SAB 121 and what it means for Bitcoin's price to cycle and the future of Bitcoin?
This is another point, like, as you said, we've been talking about this for years. We can all see this coming, right? So we can all see that Wall Street is going to start adopting Bitcoin, and the traditional finance and monetary system is going to start adopting Bitcoin. They have to, because Bitcoin is inevitable. People hate that term, but it is inevitable. It's inevitable because the people of Bitcoin, true Bitcoiners, understand what it is, and they will continue to push for Bitcoin to expand and grow. It's just like, you know, again, I'm old, so I watched the entire internet movement play out, and everybody thought it was just a joke. At first, it was only used by criminals and by geeks initially, and, you know, and then it started to kind of catch on, but nobody could see the future. And then suddenly in the 2000s and especially the 20s, it just took off, and now it's ubiquitous and everybody uses the internet. And if you don't have an internet strategy, like, it's, you can't even imagine that right now. I think we're very similar with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is inevitable. It's coming. So the SAB 122, it's we knew it was coming. I'm glad it came with Trump. Thankful for it. There are downsides, though, right? I mean, Bitcoiners, it raises red flags. Your hackles get raised a little bit when you see the traditional finance system embrace our baby. Are they going to treat it well? Will they abuse it? Are they going to try to do fractional reserves with Bitcoin that they hold? All of that, I would say that's for sure going to come too, but I think very different from fiat money, very different from the dollar. You can't print more Bitcoin to bail yourself out if you get yourself in trouble. So we're going to see people get wrecked that try to play games with Bitcoin. Bitcoin flows to where it's treated best. Traditional financial institutions treat Bitcoin well, they will accumulate a lot of Bitcoin and that'll be good for them. And if they try to play little monkey games with them and little proof of stake crypto games with Bitcoin, they're going to go out of business. And I truly believe that. Like, you have to understand what a perfectly scarce asset is. An inelastic supply means you just cannot make more of Bitcoin. And if you try to play with that, you're going to get wrecked. And so we'll see, you know, and we never know who's swimming naked until the tide goes out, right? So the bull market, we're going to see all of this stuff expand and all these different services are going to explode. And we're going to see lending on Bitcoin and, you know, Bitcoin-backed mortgages and Bitcoin-backed blah, blah, blah. And it's going to be awesome. But when we hit it, then everybody's going to get over-leveraged, right? And then we're going to have a bear market. And then we're going to see who was playing games that they shouldn't have been playing, who was too over-leveraged to Bitcoin, who was doing fractional reserve lending with Bitcoin, who shouldn't have. And those people are going to get wrecked. But it's kind of hard to know that right now, who the people are that are going to get wrecked. So it is very good. It's inevitable. I think this will provide the next leg higher for the Bitcoin price during the bull market. That's why I have that price target between whatever, 200,000 and a million or so. It's going to be because institutional investors are starting to come on board with Bitcoin. People are starting to understand. States are starting to get it. Countries are starting to get it. It's still early days, though. I still don't think the whole world is just going to ape into Bitcoin this cycle and push the price up to, you know, 10 million or whatever per coin. I just think it's going to be another typical cycle. And we're going to see some impressive price appreciation in the near term, followed by a bear market that's going to wreck a lot of people. So yes, so it's very good. It's inevitable. Bitcoiners need to be aware to just keep the heart of Bitcoin, though, right? It is a bear asset. It's an asset in its own right, and it's literally a separate system. So even though banks and Wall Street are trying to take it and collect it and profit off of it, it's a separate monetary and financial system. And I think it will eventually break free. I think it will actually eventually become too big for Wall Street and too big for traditional banks. And it will eventually break free and become its own monetary and financial system separate from our current fiat system.
You know, it's an important point for people to remember, because every asset that people have owned since the dawn of time, barring, you know, precious metals that you can hold in your own right, it's been on these monetary rails, but, you know, particularly since 1913, even more so since 1971, every single asset using US dollars as your denominator operates on those rails by their rules. Bitcoin doesn't, right? It's denominated in US dollars, but ultimately people will denominate goods and services in Bitcoin. It's a $2 trillion asset now, but honest to goodness, with Bitcoin being used as collateral, you know, it can move to a $5 trillion asset very quickly with force, right? And then a $10 trillion asset, and then it can usurp the size of gold. Actually, with your, you know, you said 465, something like that, price target, or general price target, that would put us basically exactly at the 2017 peak, right? You know, a 20x from the bottom, you know, the bottom of this bear market being roughly 15 to 20, you know, 20x from there, $400,000. And so that would mean, you know, we would mirror the 2017 cycle almost to a T. You know, I hate to bring this back up, but it seems like every single cycle, right? You mentioned, you know, we have these euphoria periods. They always end in a crash. Cycles are all different, but, you know, the main thing that differs between them is the catalysts, right? In 2024, the primary catalyst, and as you mentioned, it took a while to digest, was the launch of these ETFs. Many people were looking to a strategic Bitcoin reserve, basically, you know, begging the US government to buy, you know, to pump their bags, essentially. But it seems to me more likely that the catalyst for this year will be the proliferation of, you know, Bitcoin-backed lending and other financial services using Bitcoin at these huge US financial institutions. But also the general enthusiasm around that and the prospect of that, I believe that's enough to send Bitcoin a substantial way to its peak this cycle. But again, it's extremely uncanny, right? If we put all these puzzle pieces together, if we take your price target, if we take a look at what's happening this year, and how it's like, it's an ultimate fulfillment of the Bitcoin white paper that is behind me, which is, you know, it's not white, it's black, because dark mode is superior. You know, it's an ultimate fulfillment of what Bitcoin's monetary properties allow it to do, which is serve as pristine collateral. And for me, I do think that that's enough to send Bitcoin, you know, to those heights that you're mentioning, right? Between 200 and a million, probably somewhere, you know, close to 400 before the cycle's out.
Yep. I agree. And it looks like Checkmate has a similar view as well. So who knows, right? Like we said, we all know we're going to be wrong. I would not bet anything on my price target of 475K. I think it's basically a 0% chance of hitting that exactly. But I hope I'm directionally right. And I think we will be kind of generally right on the price range and on the timing.
Phenomenal. I want to ask you about tariffs. One of Trump's primary policies that he's been trying to put forward, he's been mentioning a lot on the campaign trail. He's mentioning it now even more now that he's in office. He's mentioning abolishing the federal income tax. Personally, I would love that. I know you would really like that as well. You know, it's a major step in the direction of just doing away with the IRS entirely. He already announced that he would be axing those 88,000 new IRS employees that were hired by the Biden administration early last year, late 2022. And he would be redirecting them to the border, which obviously you can't take people from a desk job and make them soldiers. But, you know, it was something that he mentioned. So he's already talked about this. He's talked about, you know, tariffing other countries. And he mentioned that, you know, the periods within which the United States relied on tariffs as the primary source of income rather than the federal income tax and issuing all of our debt for people to purchase, that was when American citizens, relatively speaking, were the richest they've ever been. Should we do away with the income tax, you know, either slowly or quickly, you know, slowly or all at once, like a gradual, you know, making it lower and lower until we no longer use it, or just getting rid of it wholesale? If this were to happen and we were to replace it with tariffs, you know, kind of hypothetically speaking, you know, coming out of the realm of possibility, how do you think that would look? What do you think the process would be to gradually move from a federal income tax to funding ourselves primarily with tariffs? And what impact do you think that would have on the economy and price inflation?
Yeah, so I've actually been posting about this lately on Nostra as well over the last couple of weeks, because I think if ever there was a time to abolish the IRS, which I've been calling for, and abolish the Fed, which is a different topic, but abolish income taxes, the time is now, right? I believe it was Lincoln back around towards the end of the Civil War who founded and established the IRS back in like 1865 or something like that. And then federal income taxes came about in 1913. If ever there was a time to abolish them, it is now, right? I mean, how much would Trump love to be, you know, Lincoln started it and I ended it. Like, how cool would that be? He would put himself up there with the great presidents of the past. People ask, what would you replace it with? I say nothing, right? There's that Thomas Sowell quote, that famous quote, like, you know, it's like, if you're going to abolish cancer from a patient's body, what would you replace it with? Like nothing. Like, what are you talking about? Wouldn't that have a huge impact on the federal government? Yes. And that's good. Like, the federal government is way too big. It's super inefficient. It's very harmful overall for the US people for beginners and for the rest of the world, definitely. I think, and this is getting way off topic here, but I think the federal government is way too powerful and they control the money. They control the production and the regulation of money. And because of that, they have almost unlimited power. They've become the most powerful nation state in the history of the world. That's not a good thing. That's not good for humanity. It's terrible for humanity. And so people who, you know, come at me and they're like, wow, what are you going to do without it? Who would build the roads? I'm like, yeah, the people. Right? I mean, what are you talking about? You think the federal government workers come out and build roads for us, right? All they do is take our money and then they shunt it to where they want to put it. And then they grow ever larger and they literally, and I say this a lot too, the US dollar is the most effective purchasing power extraction tool that's ever been created. It literally just exists to suck your purchasing power away from the people and give it to the government. And that's a whole nother discussion. We could talk for hours about that, right? And that's what Bitcoin fixes. It literally turns that whole equation on its head. And so it brings the power and the purchasing power back to the people and away from the government. So I think we are already seeing a geopolitical shift because of Bitcoin. As Bitcoin continues to grow and the people start to have more and more purchasing power, they have more say in how the world is run. The huge nation states government that control fiat, they're going to start to shrink over time. And so they're going to be forced to, they can fight it if they want to, and lots of them will. So that, you know, the more left-leaning, the more communist and socialist type governments, they are going to fight tooth and nail to hold on to the power and the size that they have, but they're going to lose over time. For the first time in the history of humanity, we have a technology to help us to defeat these huge centralized nation states, all-powerful governments, right, with their monopolies on violence. And so it's the sovereign individual prophecies are actually, I think, starting to come true. And it's being forced by Bitcoin and being forced by the internet and the widespread distribution of data and the widespread distribution of money. So to me, we are actually starting to see the early signs of this. So I'm encouraged when Trump talks about, he says, you know, we're going to get rid of these 88,000, you know, IRS workers and put them on the border. Great. You know, I think you should be embarrassed if you are an American and you work for the IRS. That's a despicable and deplorable job. I was personally affected by Operation Chokepoint 2.0 and all of these things from the past administration. It's not that I'm hugely pro-Trump. It's that I despise the administration that was just in place. They made my life miserable, my personal life and my professional life. I know lots of other people, especially in the Bitcoin space, their lives were made miserable by the past administration. I hope they come to justice. I doubt that they will, but I hope that, you know, justice is served on these people that made life miserable for other Americans. So anyways, the federal government should shrink. If it shrinks by 90%, it's still 10% too big, and it still has another 100% to go until it goes all the way to zero. I think state control is basically all that we need. You can, a federal government, sure, right, if there's a world war, but I would argue on the converse side of that, because people are like, well, what do you do if there's a world war and we don't have a federal government? I'm like, well, first of all, these huge nation state governments, they're in the business of world wars. They're in the business of always being in conflict with other countries. And so I think the military-industrial complex is way too big, and it causes way more harm to humanity than good. And these are the tools and the playthings of these huge federal governments. And who pays for it? People, with their money, their purchasing power, and with their lives. Like, are you kidding me? I have young kids. If the government told me I had to send my kids over to fight some stupid war on the other side of the world and they could possibly die, I would be outraged by that, right? And so anyways, you're getting me going a little bit, sorry about that, but
that's good, that's good.
I would love to see Trump abolish the income taxes. That's a great place to start, and then just abolish the IRS to begin with. They do not need that money. What they need to do is to become way more efficient and to shrink down and to quit. The US government is bankrupt, right? We have all these entitlements, Social Security, we're paying, you know, all of our debt payments, blah, blah, blah. There's, you know, Medicare, Medicaid. We cannot afford this. We are a bankrupt nation. And so by printing money, all we're doing is we're expanding the monetary supply, the credit base, and we're debasing the population to do that. And we're spreading out that wealth throughout the world to places where I don't agree with almost anything that the government does and all these decisions that we make. So I'm all for it. Abolish the IRS, abolish the income tax. Replace it with nothing. That's a really long answer to your question, but that's where I land.
Excellent. Get rid of it all. Because ultimately, right, it's so bloated, it costs us an extreme amount of money. I was just looking at my W-2 I got in the mail yesterday, which I don't know why we do. I have a digital copy of it. And I was paying out, you know, several thousand dollars, right, in Social Security taxes. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, I'm never going to receive any of this. I'm not going to get any of this back, because over the next 75 years, our unfunded obligations are like $75 trillion. And it's like entirely Social Security and Medicare. Like it makes up 100% of the unfunded obligation. And so to me, looking at these two programs, I get, you know, it's a perfect encapsulation of how wildly inefficient the federal government is. And if we simply downsized, if we got rid of these things, it would no longer be an issue. You know, in absolute prosperity and relative prosperity, right, on the individual level, would rise. And I do think that these measures Trump is taking, consciously or unconsciously, they are in an effort to severely downsize the U.S. government. He talks about, you know, draining the swamp. I think one of the biggest measures that went a little bit unspoken was forcing all federal employees to come back to work 5 days a week. I think you're going to get probably, you know, 15 to 20% of people quitting right off the bat because of that, because they've structured their lifestyles around living far away from D.C., you know, basically spending their entire day at home with their kids, which I don't mind. That's wonderful, right? Spend as much time with your kids as you want. But if you are a federal employee, right, and you're not putting in the hours whatsoever, why are you on the payroll? And so it seems like these two measures are just emblematic of what's to come. It seems like, consciously or unconsciously, he is doing these things to reduce the size of the federal government, reduce the bloat. And I think in doing so, it will allow those things that you've been talking about, you know, on your Nostr profile, free Ross, check, abolish the IRS, abolish the Fed, abolish taxes on Bitcoin and purchase goods and services. It makes those other things possible, because those revenue sources, the federal income tax, are no longer needed when your government is much smaller. The main problem we now have on our hands, the main, you know, the main expense that we will ultimately have is paying down our interest on our debt. Once you reduce the bloat of the US government, you take half, 60, 70, 80, 90% of these people off the payroll. The biggest thing you have to concern yourself with is managing rates effectively, paying the interest on our debt. And it seems like that's the direction we're headed.
I think so too. And, you know, and getting to that subject, you know, what are some practical things? I think with Scott Bessent and Trump and the current group of people they have on board, they're trying to run it like an efficient business. And I think that's actually a great thing that our country needs right now, right? So what are they going to try to do? I think we're going to see economic growth be spurred. I think we're going to see inflation run hot. And I think if they can find a way to keep interest rates lower, what they're going to do is try to grow out of their huge debt problem that they have. And I think that's actually the best strategy for most people. You get everybody back to work, you bring manufacturing back. Even though inflation is running hot, it's also inflating away the debt as well. And so for at least for a time, you can start trying to grow out of this insurmountable problem that we have. I think if it would have been the other administration, if Kamala would have won, it would have been more of the same. And we would have just eventually, sooner than later, you're going to have hyperinflation because people are going to start losing confidence in their currency. And it's eventually going to go to zero, basically. And so, and the debts become just absolutely unpayable. So I think the plan that we have right now is the most palatable option considering the predicament that we're in. And if they can actually spur the economy, but also decrease the size of the federal government and reduce the bloat of the federal government, that combination actually should be effective. Most people think, well, there's no way we're going to be able to reduce it from this much debt to this much debt. But if we can go from this much debt to GDP, that's a positive development. And if we can get on a better trajectory and bring that down, the debt to GDP, that's fantastic. That will put us on a much better long-term trajectory. So that's what I think they're going for. And I think they might actually accomplish it. I'm fairly optimistic about it.
Yeah, it certainly will. I mean, you know, the CBO themselves put out an estimate like last week or the week before, just prior to Trump getting in office. And it said that, you know, their estimate for debt to GDP by 2035 was 200%, right? We're at like 115, 120 now. It's bad. But it's not as bad as it could be. If we could just reduce it marginally, we'll be in an extremely good spot. And we've always talked about these two scenarios, and a lot of it has gone into, you know, a lot of my orange pilling has revolved around, all right, what, you know, what are the two situations the U.S. government is, you know, how can we face this huge Goliath of a debt problem we have? There are two ways, right? You can grow your way out of it, or, you know, you can lock rates extremely low and, you know, inflate away the debt in real terms. It seems like, given where Trump is putting a lot of business people in charge of the things that need to be run like businesses, it seems like, just like you mentioned, we are trying to do a combination of the two, trying to keep rates low at a manageable level, but also do these things like reshoring manufacturing, right? Which will be huge. It'll make our bonds more attractive, right? You want to lend money to a business that you know is going to get more productive, that you know is going to fulfill their promises, and you know their bonds are going to be in even higher demand, right? You know, you want to get into that early. And so, you know, for me, hiring all these business people, making the government a more efficient organization, it's going to make our debt situation more manageable. You know, it's going to inflate it away at the margin, you know, because rates may be lower than the rate of inflation, but that will ultimately be a good thing because it will do things like reshoring manufacturing. It will spur economic activity. It'll make bonds more attractive. And as a net result of all of that, running the US government like a business instead of, you know, like this massive organization with no profit incentive, which it is. So in a way, these people who are being elected kind of have to pretend that there is a profit incentive in order to get this done. Well, there is the real incentive is avoiding, you know, total collapse of the system. It seems to me like the prospect of managing this debt down to a reasonable level below 100% debt to GDP is closer than it's ever been.
Absolutely. And to your point, I just wanted to pull on one of those threads. You know, I consider myself an independent. I'm not a Republican and I'm not a Democrat, even though I probably sound more. I'm definitely more right-leaning when it comes to economic policies. But the reason why, so what happens with the left, and a lot of people don't get this, like they mean very well, right? And what they want to do is redistribute the wealth from the rich and give it to the poor. That's kind of what they want to do. That's great on a primary level, but second order effects of that, like what we saw with COVID, if you just push money into people's bank accounts, what that does is it drives the cost of goods higher. And so even though it has a short-term wealth effect, it leads to long-term problems. You have higher inflation. Now prices are permanently higher going forward, and there's no growth that comes out of it. So it's not good for the economy to just give free money to people. What I like about the policies on the right, and especially with the new administration who's on board, they want to take the power and the flows, the monetary flows of the country, and direct them into things that have a positive ROI. So they actually want to put it into things and get people back to work. What's way better for a country is to have more and more people working and building things that are built to last, that help develop the strength of the economy. And so if they're directing money, instead of just giving people free money, but putting it into manufacturing, creating a ton of new jobs and helping, like, we could have better roads with less potholes, right? We could have better infrastructure. Way more people are working. We have the return, the rise and return of the middle class. That is fantastic for the economy, not only today, but as you go forward, it starts to have exponential effects on the economy going forward. And that's the way that you grow out of these debt problems. And so for me, that's what's really encouraging, is to actually see, okay, we're going to see some positive things come out. We're going to see actual measures that actually cause the country to grow going forward. And it actually looks like a more optimistic view for our children and for our grandchildren going forward. So anyways, great points that you brought up. And I think that it's a subtle point that most people who are heavily political, they don't really think about, because they feel like it's less compassionate to not just give money to people, to not do entitlements for people. But that has, even though it looks good in the short term, it's negative or deleterious in the long run. And this side is a much better way to help people come out of poverty over the long term. So anyways, optimistic about that.
Absolutely. You know, it's many people, the majority of people, unfortunately, cannot think in terms of second, third, and fourth order effects. I'm very happy that some of the people who are coming into this administration can do that, right? And they understand that. And ultimately, it will be better for all, right? One side may be kicking and screaming the entire way, you know, to prosperity land, but we will ultimately, hopefully, arrive in prosperity land. You know, one of the last things I want to ask you about, I want to shift gears back to the Bitcoin discussion. Over the last couple of years, we have seen this shift away from crypto to Bitcoin. It seems like Trump using the term digital assets, you know, in this executive order, shifting from middle of last year when he was actually saying Bitcoin and crypto, which is good, you know, distinguishing these two things from each other. He's now kind of regressed in the other direction, talking about digital assets. Do you believe we are still in that secular shift away from crypto, as evidenced by the ETH BTC pair, the XRP BTC pair, which is recently the talk of the town as a result of, you know, Ripple Labs pouring millions of dollars into the Trump campaign? Do you still think we're in that secular shift away from crypto and into Bitcoin, or do you think that we're going to have a resounding resurgence in this, all this other crap during this year?
Unfortunately, I don't. I think that we are going. I was cautiously optimistic that we had seen the worst of the crypto circus, and I think that it's going to be much worse now. So it's very discouraging for me to see this, and to see all of the crypto bros that are encouraging Trump to make his policies. I don't see almost any full-fledged Bitcoiner that's whispering in his ear, all crypto bros. I know that the crypto crowd is rejoicing, and you know what, by the way, I don't care. Like, they can do that if they want to. People, it's a free country. It should be a free country. You should be allowed to speculate in whatever you want. To me, it's just like the proliferation of gambling, online gambling, sports betting, Las Vegas, you know, all of these casino places. Like, that's great. If you want to do that, if you think it's fun, if you like to be entertained and you like to, you know, gamble, go for it, you know. But it's not Bitcoin, and it has nothing to do with Bitcoin. And it's frustrating for me, and I know it is for you, for people who have been out in the, you know, in the battlefield for the last 5 years or so, trying to help people distinguish the difference between proof of stake crypto and proof of work Bitcoin, and they have nothing relevant to do with each other. And, you know, Bitcoin was designed to be the world's decentralized, secure, international energy money. And then you have all these other things, like, and you got Ripple, you know, trying to whisper in his ear that it's just as good as Bitcoin. It drives me nuts, right? And it's unfortunate. I liken it to, I always try to think of analogies that help people explain. It's like you're in a wartime and you have an aircraft carrier from the US, like the best, biggest, most powerful warcraft carrier ever, coming in to save the day. And then you have people planning, like, hey, you know what? We need to put a casino on that work, on that aircraft carrier. We need to put a movie theater on there too, so that people will be entertained and the soldiers will focus on that. And it's like such a distraction, and it's so stupid, and it offers nothing beneficial over the long run. But now people conflate the two and they think they're the same. Like, I still have people today who are like, oh, you're Dr. Jeff, you're the Bitcoin guy. He's like, oh, and I'm like, yeah. And they're like, yeah, I saw you on some show, and And so I bought some Bitcoin. It's called Ripple. And I bought some Bitcoin and it's called Doge. Do you know, do you like Doge? It's not Bitcoin, you know? And so you have to go through all of this stuff again. And I think, unfortunately, because of the people who are coming on board, we are going to have an absolute circus and it's going to be crazy. And I think as the bull market rages on in Bitcoin, I think that all of these proof of stake cryptos are just going to absolutely go wild and proliferate. And I think it's going to be worse than 2022. So all of the lessons from 2022 with FTX and with BlockFi and with Voyager and with all these other places, that's nothing. I think it will pale in comparison to what is coming. And I think people are going to get absolutely destroyed. And so my one last piece of advice for people is, like, you can speculate in that stuff if you want to, but save in Bitcoin. Please, please, please save in Bitcoin and don't use leverage. Or you're going to get wrecked, and I promise you, you'll get wrecked. And even governments might start getting wrecked. I mean, are you kidding me? If you start putting, like, proof of stake crypto on the balance sheets of governments, it's just going to be a disaster. So, yeah, that's how I feel about it.
You know, sometimes people need to learn those lessons not once, not twice, not three times, maybe four or five times before it sinks in. And I think maybe the U.S. government will be in that boat.
Yes.
You know, I tend to hope, I tend to believe that after this next crash, like, you know, currently in U.S. dollar terms, everything else makes up about, you know, all this other crap in the reserve makes up about 2.5%. I tend to think that, you know, after the next cycle's crash, it may make up 1%. And then after that point, right, people may take a second look at it, but it may take even longer. Mm-hmm. The last thing I have for you, Checkmate called the proliferation of crypto the rise of financial nihilism. Right. So, and you mentioned sports betting, right? Crypto is essentially another form of this financial nihilism, right? People realizing, recognizing in one way or another that there's very little hope for them to do the things they want to do, right? Start a family, get married young, you know, pursue a career that they love rather than one that they're forced to do for monetary reasons. They feel that that is increasingly out of reach. And so they're resorting to, you know, these other speculative things. They're essentially buying 100 different versions of a lottery ticket, you know, several times a day, you know, in an attempt to, right, get rich quick. So to the people who are financial nihilists out there, to the people who may see no hope for the future, what message do you have for them?
First of all, I don't blame you for being desperate, right? This is what the fiat system does, is it creates desperate people. It creates people who are stuck on the hamster wheel and you're working harder and harder and harder to make less and less and less relatively, right? You can barely afford groceries now. You can barely afford your car. You can't afford your doctor bills. Like, all of these things, it's just so you can't just do that with one job. So now you have two jobs. And now you and your spouse are both working two jobs. And you're picking up some side gigs on the side too, just to be able to support your family. Or maybe you don't even have a family because you don't think you can even support kids. This is the result. It's not the result of greedy corporations. It's not the result of anything else other than the government, who creates money and expands the monetary supply. It creates these distortions because of the Cantillon effect, right? The people who are close to the money spigot, they get the benefits of this increased monetary supply. The people who are far away, who are the renter class, they get poorer and poorer and poorer and more frustrated. And the income inequality gets worse and worse and worse because of these monetary policies. And almost nobody understands that. I will tell you that it makes you desperate, and I get it. But I will also tell you that Bitcoin fixes this, and that's for real that it fixes this. So what I tell people is, even if you have an extra dollar a day or an extra 25 cents a day left over, I would say, please put that in Bitcoin. Start saving in Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a technology. It's a monetary technology that helps the quality of your life to improve and get cheaper over time versus the dollar and everything dollar related. So crypto and lottery tickets and all of this other stuff, and even stocks, penny stocks, meme stocks, stuff that people get into. Those are all these desperate attempts to get rich quickly, but they have no lasting value or very little lasting value. And you have way more of a chance of getting wrecked over time than actually striking it rich and making it big. So I just tell people, like, just, you know, be conservative. Matt Odell has the best quote that I think that everybody should take to heart. Stay humble, stack sats. Like, that's all you got to do. And if you do that, if you put your head down and work hard and stack sats, regardless of the price of Bitcoin, if you do that for 10 years, you will have a different life 10 years from now. And I know that seems like a long time for people, but look, I work in the financial business. I work with people who are thinking about retirement 20, 30, 40 years from now, from wherever they are starting out. Bitcoin speeds up that process, and it gives you financial optionality and independence much sooner than any other assets do. So don't lose hope. Just stack sats, work hard, and eventually your time will come. Bitcoin, the price will take care of itself over time.
Fantastic. Avoid get-rich-quick schemes. You'll lose all your money. onboard yourself to Bitcoin. It is the world's first and only get-rich-slow scheme. Dr. Jeff, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it, man. Always, always great chatting with you. Great to see you again. Before we sign off here, where can people find you and your work?
Like I said at the beginning of the show, I don't have any other accounts other than my Nostr account. You can find me on Nostr. It's Dr. Jeff. Please don't get scammed by any other accounts. I'm not ever going to ask you for money. I'm not going to try to get you to invest in some secret fund. Come find me on there if you're interested. And Joe, thanks for having me on. I always love chatting with you, and I'm honored to be on your show.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot. I appreciate that. And yeah, if you are looking to follow Dr. Jeff on Nostr, I'm going to link the Primal in the description. And again, it's Dr. Jeff. Don't fall for the scams. Once again, thanks so much for watching the Theia podcast. I'll talk to you soon.